I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 29th of October. In October, just a couple weeks ago, you'll recall this story that a Milwaukee jury awarded Milwaukee police officers, almost $6 million. It was a lawsuit against Badger Gun, and it sold the weapon that was used to shoot the officers later. These injuries were serious, and the team that represented the officers argued their case falls under an exception to the federal immunity law, which holds a gun seller liable if that person knowingly violates a federal gun control law. There was reason to believe that the person who sold the gun was witnessing an illegal straw purchase. We'll talk more about that this hour. And whether this will obviously be appealed, this award, it may go all the way to the Supreme Court. Joining us this hour to talk about this particular case and others is Timothy Litton. He's distinguished university professor and professor of law at Georgia State University. And he teaches regulatory policy, administrative law, and torts. He's the author of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. His law degree and undergraduate degrees are from Yale University, and he's written many books on gun violence, clergy sexual abuse, and food regulation, and has served as a research fellow at Yale Law School and a fellow in the Harvard Program on Ethics and the Professions. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Litton during the course of this hour. To join our conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Timothy, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Did this case make so much national attention because this kind of case is rare? There aren't many people who are taking on people who sell guns?
Well, if you go back and look back to the 1980s, starting in the 1980s, victims of gun violence started to bring lawsuits not just against the people who shot them, but the people who sold the weapons. And most of those cases were against retail stores.
Mm.
And this phenomenon of suing the gun seller rather than just the shooter grew over time. And by the late 1990s, there were actually a lot of lawsuits, and they were against not just retail gun stores, but they were also against manufacturers. And into the mix came a number of cities. About 30 cities around the United States started suing gun industry manufacturers, distributors, and gun stores for the costs of dealing with gun violence in their cities. And this sort of mushroomed into a fairly large wave of litigation against the industry. The industry fought this not only in court, but also went to state legislatures in about 30 different states, and they secured immunity legislation from civil liability in each of those states. And finally, in 2005, they secured immunity legislation from Congress, and that made them immune from suit throughout the United States. And this wave of lawsuits against the gun industry really almost came to a halt. There was a small trickle afterwards. The Brady Center for Gun Violence brought a few more suits and has continued in this arena, but private lawyers and, for the most part, municipalities stopped. And so this lawsuit in Milwaukee was a bit of a surprise because this litigation has pretty much not only been out of the news, but really only a small trickle since about 2005 when the federal immunity statute was passed.
Interesting. Are there other industries in this country that have such broad immunity?
Well, there are instances in which Congress has granted immunity from civil liability to industries. One of the most famous examples is that the vaccine industry has immunity from Congress for civil liability for injuries resulting from a vaccine. It turns out that some percentage of people who get the vaccine will inevitably have a bad reaction, and those lawsuits threaten the viability of the industry and really threaten the shortage of the vaccine. And so Congress stepped in and granted immunity from civil liability for the vaccine industry. But generally, when Congress has done this, they have given back something while they've taken away the right to sue. So on the one hand, where individuals may no longer sue in tort against the vaccine manufacturers, there's a separate compensation fund for victims of vaccine injuries, and that's been established by Congress to give back something to victims who can no longer sue. The same is true, by the way, with the airline industry. After 9/11, Congress granted immunity to the airline industry for lawsuits arising out of the terrorist attacks and gave back at the same time a compensation fund. this immunity for the firearms industry is unusual, not because it's industry-wide immunity from civil liability, but because it's industry-wide immunity without a give-back of, in terms of some sort of compensation system in its place.
Mm-hmm. But there is an exception to the federal immunity law, which will hold a gun seller liable, you've written, if he knowingly violates a federal gun control law.
That's right. There are actually a number of exceptions to the immunity. The bill essentially is designed to prohibit any kind of claim against a gun manufacturer or a gun seller where the injury resulted from a criminal misuse of a weapon. So if, for example, you buy a weapon and it misfires or backfires, that's a defect in the weapon. That's not barred by the suit. You can bring a product liability claim against the manufacturer. Or in other circumstances, if there's a warranty problem or a contract problem, manufacturers are not immune from suit. Now, there are two important exceptions, one of which you mentioned, where there's an exception to the immunity for cases that arise out of criminal misuse of the weapon. And one of them is what's called negligent entrustment. That's where the gun seller gives over the weapon to somebody who's a very high risk. And the standard example of this is if you entrust a loaded weapon to a small child or a visibly deranged person. And the other is if the sale occurs in a way that involves a knowing transfer and violation of a federal law. So those are the two things that were alleged in the Milwaukee case. The victims in that case alleged that the store clerk, on the one hand, knowingly violated federal law because he had reason to believe that he was facilitating an illegal straw purchase of the weapon, and there were a number of indicators or red flags for that. And the plaintiffs also claimed that selling the weapon in this manner was a form of negligent entrustment, and that those are exceptions to the immunity bill, and on that basis, the judge sent the case to the jury, and the jury came back with a verdict for the police officers.
So what were the red flags that indicated a straw purchase was taking place?
Well, there was evidence at trial that when the two characters involved here who were involved in the crime were a young man named Julius Burton, who was only 18 and ineligible to buy a weapon legally, and Jacob Collins, who was 21, who went into the store to buy the weapon illegally for Burton. So it turns out that there was evidence at trial that when Burton, who was the minor, went into the store, Collins and Burton went in together, and Burton, the minor, pointed out the guns that he wanted Collins to buy. And Collins, when he was filling out the background check form, which is federally mandated, marked initially that he wasn't actually the buyer. And then he changed the form, and the clerk seemed to help him change the form so that he appeared to be the buyer, even though it was a straw purchase. And the jury foreperson who was interviewed after the case was decided said that the jury was concerned about what they considered, quote, shoddy, unquote, business practices. They said that the store didn't have any policies to help its clerks avoid or spot straw purchases. It didn't train its workers, that the people in the store didn't seem very aware of the federal regulations that govern firearm sales, and that nobody in the store seemed very well versed in filling out the forms, and that the co-owner of the store, Mike Biadovic, actually testified that he thought these were red flags, and I think that was probably very damaging to the defense case.
It certainly sounds like they were shoddy business practices. If you're selling a lethal weapon, there are things that you ought to be very careful about, right, to make sure that the person who's buying the weapon is of age and that you know how to, I mean, you're required to fill out a background check. How can you not know how to do that if you're selling guns?
Right. I mean, this is such a obvious set of safety precautions that even the industry association, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the NSSF, which is the trade association for gun manufacturers, they've been running a program since 2000 called Don't Lie for the Other Guy. And it's designed to help stores train their employees in how to spot these types of straw purchases and to put signage around the store and to do things to discourage these kinds of practices. And it looks like this store involved in the Milwaukee case, Badger Guns, really wasn't at all on board with this industry effort to stop straw purchases. And in fact, there was evidence at trial that Badger Guns has been so irresponsible that it was declared the top seller of guns traced to crimes in the U.S. in 2005. There were 537 guns traced back to the store that were recovered in crimes around the area. And it had been on the top 10 list of ATF for crime guns for 10 years from 95 to 2005.
But nothing was done about it until now.
Well, there was an attempt to try and remove the license from the store, federal license to sell weapons. And so the store changed ownership by shifting it from one person in the family to another and continued to go ahead and sell. So it looked like there probably was relatively weak enforcement on the part of the federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the jury was swayed at all because these officers who were so badly injured were police officers?
I think that's probably part of the case here. I think another important feature of the case is, in some of the cases that were brought before the immunity bill, there were clearly these kinds of irresponsible sales practices, but the connection between the actual irresponsible sales practice and the actual shooting often seemed to be attenuated, by which I mean sometimes the gun was purchased and then sold and resold several times, or was introduced into the black market, or there was a long passage of time, or it was borrowed by another person, and the distance between the irresponsible sales practice and the shooting was too far. In this case, it was actually very close. It was a matter of weeks before between the illegal sale of the gun and the shooting, and the shooting was conducted by the person who was implicated in the illegal sale. So there was a very close, what they call proximate cause connection, mm-hmm. and I think that was probably one of the strongest features of this case. As far as the identity of the victims, it's often the case that these victims are quite sympathetic. These shootings often are quite grisly.
Yes. You talk about this Don't Lie for the Other Guy campaign from the National Shooting Sports Foundation, but you say that the preventive measures are voluntary, and you also say it's unlikely to become mandatory anytime soon. Why wouldn't those very simple measures be mandatory?
Well, you know, many trade associations around the United States set safety standards for their industry, and those standards are voluntary because trade associations don't really have any power to punish, like the government does. It's often the case in safety standards for a variety of different products that the federal government or state governments will then adopt those safety practices into federal or state statutes or regulations and put the power of government enforcement behind them. In the case of gun safety measures, it's unlikely just because of the politics of gun control. Gun control just doesn't seem to make its way through either the federal or state legislatures in most places these days. And even in the wake of horrific shootings in places like Oregon, very few states, and certainly not the federal government, have decided to beef up safety requirements. And so it's unlikely that these safety requirements that the trade association has are likely to be adopted into federal legislation anytime soon.
What about the liability insurers?
Well, that's a good question. I think one of the most important features of this case in Milwaukee is that even if it's true that the industry association safety measures like Don't Lie for the Other Guy are voluntary, and even if it's true that we're unlikely to see any kind of federal statute that provides the ability to enforce them by government means, I think lawsuits like this open up gun stores to the threat of civil liability, which is actually, in this case, $5.7 million for one lawsuit, and that adds a very powerful incentive to gun stores to comply with these voluntary standards. And so even if they're voluntary, it now becomes extremely expensive because in case of violation, you could be subject to liability.
Mm-hmm. You talk about critics who say that it's unfair to hold gun sellers liable for the conduct of criminals who misuse the weapons that they sell, comparing holding gun store owners liable for shootings to asking car dealers responsible for crimes committed with cars, like bank robberies. Are there other criticisms of this?
Well, I think the problem with the analogy and the idea that what's really going on here is that the law is holding gun sellers liable for the misdeeds of criminals is that's not really what the liability suits are about. The liability suits are about holding gun sellers liable for their own misdeeds. And the misdeed in this case is not the shooting. The misdeed in this case is facilitating an illegal straw purchase.
Mm-hmm.
The facilitation of an illegal straw purchase is wrong. And because of that, the person who does that, i.e. the gun store, ought to be liable. And that's the argument here. So it's a bit of a red herring to say what's really going on here is we're holding the gun store liable because someone used the weapon to shoot. If someone goes in and makes a perfectly legal purchase and then goes out and misuses the weapon, there's no question of liability. You're not liable for selling that
weapon.
But if you facilitate an illegal purchase, you've done something wrong. And if that wrong act causes injury relatively quickly, as it did in this case, you're liable for it. So it's the analogy is sort of misdrawn, I think.
Mm-hmm. Timothy, do we have any idea how many illegal straw purchases there are in this country?
We don't. We have some indication in federal statistics that the gun industry also has some statistics that indicate that the percentage of guns recovered in crimes are generally more likely to be stolen than purchased in a straw purchase.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really have a sense of how many straw purchases occur because many of them go undetected. We don't have a clear idea of what percentage of crime guns are sold originally in a straw purchase, because most crime guns are not recovered or traced. But one thing I think everyone agrees on, and certainly the industry's, you know, don't lie for the other guy policy and standards are designed to deal with this, is that straw purchases are a problem. And even if they're a moderate problem or a marginal problem, they're kind of low-hanging fruit. That is, they're a problem that we could address, unlike many of the other problems associated with gun violence. And so I think that's part of what makes them such a focus of attention. This is one of the areas of gun control where we might actually be able to make some progress. And both the industry and the government and the Brady people seem to agree that straw purchases are a problem, no matter how big or small they are, and that we ought to do something about them.
So it eventually, I have read, may go to the Supreme Court, this case. Do you imagine it will?
Well, it's always difficult to anticipate what's going to make it to the Supreme Court. I think there's likely to be an appeal in this case, and the appeal is going to revolve around a number of technical issues, one of which is what the meaning of negligent entrustment is in the context of the statute and whether it's been stretched or properly applied in this case, and whether or not the standard for the exception that says you're liable if you conduct a knowing violation of federal or state law regarding the sale of a firearm, whether or not the standard of proof for that is the civil standard, i.e. a preponderance of the evidence that you knowingly violated the law, or the criminal standard, i.e. beyond a reasonable doubt that you knowingly violated the law. And it's a little bit murky because it's a civil statute, but it refers to a criminal act, which is the knowing violation of a federal statute. So those are things that are going to be up on appeal. The Milwaukee courts are going to have to deal with that before it gets anywhere near the Supreme Court.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Timothy Litton. He's distinguished university professor and professor of law at Georgia State University. He is the author of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. And he's written many books on gun violence, clergy, sexual abuse, and food regulation. And we are referencing this hour the purchase that took place. It was an illegal straw purchase that took place in Milwaukee, and the person who got the gun subsequently shot and seriously injured two police officers pretty soon after he got the weapon. The Milwaukee jury who heard this case in October, just a little while ago, awarded these police officers $5.7 million against the store that sold the weapon that was used to shoot the police officers. So we're looking at the immunity, federal immunity law, the exceptions to the federal immunity law, how many straw purchases, illegal straw purchases are taking place in this country, and should the industry bear some responsibility for policing the people who sell guns? What do you think? We would like very much to hear from you. There used to be more of this, as Timothy reminded us early on in the show. Victims used to use tort claims to promote safer firearms, to deter future sales, he writes, to criminals, and to place part of the blame for gun violence on the industry. But with the immunity statute that was passed in 2005, I believe, these suits kind of went by the wayside. So he has written a book examining lawsuits against the gun industry, and we will talk more about those as we carry on. Here's how you reach our conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number again, join us, 800-486-8655, as we talk about this awarding of $5.7 million to the officers who were shot by someone who bought a gun illegally, and the person who sold the gun at Badger Guns, the jury said, knew that there was an illegal straw purchase, and thus the award. So we're looking a bit at the history, the immunity that the gun industry has from prosecution, and how significant this case is. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. What are your thoughts about this case? Nate in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thank you. One of the things I was calling about, and I was hoping your guests would be able to clarify this for me, is I had heard that some of the more gun-friendly members of Congress had actually passed laws making it harder for police to trace guns and track their history. And what I mean by that would be if they arrest a criminal who has a firearm on him, they can't do some of the history or some of the tracing of the actual gun unless they suspected of being used in a specific shooting. So if they catch like a mugger or a drug dealer and he's got a bunch of weapons, they can't actually test them all to see where they've potentially been or been involved with.
Timothy?
Well, Nate, I don't know a specific answer to your question regarding specific restrictions on the tracing of guns that are found on a person who, you know, who hasn't misused them. But I can say that Congress in many junctures in the last several decades has put limits on not only the ability to trace weapons, but also the publication and the sharing of information regarding traces. So one of the reasons why it's now difficult to obtain information regarding statistics in terms of gun tracing and why we don't know much about Badger Guns record after 2005 is that in 2005, Congress passed a measure that limited ATF's ability to share its tracing information, and the primary reason for that was to keep it out of the hands of plaintiffs' attorneys who were bringing these lawsuits. So there are a number of situations in which Congress, while they understand that there's gun tracing information that's being collected by the United States, is limiting people's ability to access it and also the uses to which it can be put.
Anything further, Nate?
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Thanks for the call. 800-486-8655 is our number. Tell me about how many lawsuits were brought before 2005 and some of the more interesting cases when there were big losses or big wins.
Well, you know, one of the earliest cases of note was in 1998, and that was brought a case called Halberstam versus Daniel. And I think there are a lot of people who have been led to believe that these lawsuits, or many of them, were frivolous. There were several dozen lawsuits brought by individuals, and probably 20 or 30 states brought them. There were a couple, municipalities. There were a couple states, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, when it was under the direction of Andrew Cuomo, who's now the governor of New York, also brought a lawsuit. And many people denounced these, especially in the industry, as frivolous. Many of them were dismissed, and in fact, most of them did not reach trial. They were dismissed before trial. A handful of them reached trial, and most of them at trial were not decided in favor of the plaintiffs. And the one case where a plaintiff prevailed in a jury trial was overturned on appeal. So they were relatively unsuccessful in the courts, but they did a number of things that were important. They uncovered information about the gun industry's practices, distribution practices, that I don't think were widely appreciated, and they focused interest and attention on the role that the industry played in the leaking of guns into the black market. And there's a particular case, Halberstam versus Daniel in 1998, that I think nicely illustrates the point. In that case, the lawsuit arose out of a shooting in the 1990s on the Brooklyn Bridge. There was a gentleman who used an automatic pistol to shoot a vanload of children on the Brooklyn Bridge, and the families of the children, many of whom perished, brought a lawsuit against the gun manufacturer. The gun in question was called the Cobra M119, and it was a fairly notorious gun. They advertised the gun as the gun that made the 80s roar, and it was reviewed in Machine Gun News as a gun that was useful for, quote, cleaning out a phone booth or an elevator.
Oh, my gosh.
And they sold this gun in an interesting fashion. Now, normally when you sell a gun, it has to have a serial number, which allows for tracing, and it has to be sold if it's sold across state lines from one federal firearms licensee to another. But the company that sold this gun, the Daniels Company, sold the gun as a parts kit, so that if you sell a gun, it has to conform to federal law. But if you sell a scope or a magazine or some piece of a gun, it's actually largely unregulated. So what they did is they took this gun and they broke it into pieces, and they sold it as a parts kit. And instead of having a receiver, which is the part of the gun that would have to bear the serial number, they sent a sheet metal flat with instructions how to fold it up into a receiver, and you could attach the other parts to it. And they sold these guns over the telephone with discounts for bulk purchases with no information necessary other than credit card number. And they sold lots of these guns, and between 1993 and 1998, over 3,000 of them were recovered in crimes, and all of the ones that were recovered in crimes were traced back to this manufacturer. And during the course of the litigation, the owners of the manufacturing company basically said they didn't know who bought their weapons, and they didn't care who bought their weapons. In that case, which went to a jury, the jury actually found that the gun manufacturer was careless, and on that basis might be subject to liability. And the problem in that case was, as I mentioned before, there was a relatively attenuated link between these careless practices and the actual shooting.
Yes.
The gun in question in this particular crime had gone through a number of different owners and over a long period of time, and the jury found that the connection was just not close enough, and on that basis did not find in favor of the plaintiff. But it gives you some idea about what irresponsible practices might look like and why it is that they might give rise to civil liability, and that even if the cases were to lose for a variety of reasons, they're certainly not frivolous.
So the manufacturer must have known who the possible buyer was going to be. What in the world were they thinking?
I think this is a case where the manufacturer just didn't care who the purchaser was, and that they were making a gun that was sort of exciting to a certain group of people, and there are a lot of people, you know, who play fantasy games that involve a lot of ugly behavior, and there I imagine people who are gun enthusiasts who like a gun that has associated with it ugly behavior. There also happen to be gun purchasers who want to use it to commit crimes, and it seems to me that in a case like this, the manufacturer just doesn't really care who buys the weapons, and as long as it's legal, they're willing to do it. And I think the point that this underscores is that the law of torts has an important function to play in our regulatory system in America, and that is there are many forms of conduct that are perfectly legal and that may be difficult or undesirable to outlaw. We might not want to restrict purchases of firearms because we might be worried that it would not allow people to purchase them if we believe that people ought to have a right to own a private weapon. But that if someone does it in an irresponsible manner, they ought to at least pay damages. And the tort system provides for that. It provides a way to hold a person responsible for legal behavior that causes another person injury.
Yeah. Let's go to John in Eau Claire next. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, what you were just talking about kind of helped me to narrow down my question a little bit. About suing the gun manufacturers themselves, has there been a recent case where a gun, unlike the Cobra without a serial number where the person built it themselves, is there a recent case where a manufacturer has successfully been sued for just selling a complete gun put together, and how exactly does that make them liable if it's just a regular, commonly used firearm?
So that's a great question. Let me talk for a minute about the type of theories that used to be brought against manufacturers before the immunity bill. Before the immunity bill, a lot of the lawsuits that were brought against manufacturers were brought on the basis of what was called negligent marketing. Now, a very egregious form of negligent marketing is this Halberstam versus Daniel form where they're selling these guns as parts kits and they're trying to clearly circumvent the law. But another type of argument is that manufacturers, because trace data often is given to them by ATF because the manufacturers are involved in the tracing process when ATF is trying to figure out where the gun was manufactured that's recovered in crime, manufacturers often know where it is that the guns found in crime are traced back to, which stores. So, for example, the stores that supply Badger guns in Wisconsin are in possession of information that indicates to them that Badger guns is responsible for the sale of 537 guns sold in crime in a particular year. And plaintiffs in many cases argued that it's careless if you are a manufacturer not to police your distribution chain more carefully, that if you know that among the variety of gun sellers who you distribute your weapons to, there's one in particular in Milwaukee who seems to be selling a disproportionate number of weapons that show up in gun violence cases, that you ought to do something about that, and that the failure to police your distribution chain is a kind of either oversupply or negligent marketing. And on that basis, the manufacturer might be held liable. Now, that particular theory was actually shut down by the immunity bill. And in fact, many courts before the immunity bill rejected the theory. Many of the cases were dismissed. There is one case now that arises out of the shooting in Sandy Hook, the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And that lawsuit is against Bushmaster, the manufacturer of the gun that Adam Lanza used. And that argument is an argument about what they call negligent entrustment. The argument in that case is that the manufacturer produced a gun, Bushmaster produced a gun that really was designed for combat use, and that it was negligent to market that on the market for sort of the general public in regular old gun stores in neighborhoods, and that doing so is a form of negligent entrustment. The question in that case is not so much whether or not it's negligent to do this, but whether it conforms to the traditional idea of negligent entrustment, which is traditionally this idea of giving a gun to a deranged person or a person who visibly is intoxicated or a small child. The courts are going to have to decide that, but there are these instances where the manufacturer's practices might be considered irresponsible. And as I said before, while many of the cases failed, in fact, most of them failed to even reach a jury, we now know a lot more about what manufacturers know and how they think about their supply chain than we did before anyone brought these lawsuits.
Okay. I've never heard it explained like that before. That's awesome.
Thank you, John, very much for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Timothy Litton. He's distinguished university professor and professor of law at Georgia State University. We're talking about the jury in Milwaukee a couple weeks ago awarding two Milwaukee police officers $5.7 million for severe injuries that they sustained at the hands of a young man who used a gun that he had purchased at Badger Guns in Milwaukee. It was an illegal straw purchase, and thus the awarding of this. And the jury found that the business practices were very shoddy in this store, and we've outlined why they felt that way. We're looking at immunity that has been granted in 2005. We'll ask our guest if we didn't have immunity, considering all the shootings that have taken place recently, has the tide changed in that regard? He still doesn't think that there will be significant gun control legislation. But considering how many mass shootings there have been, is the political climate different now? And I'm interested in why in 2005 that bill was passed by Congress. So we're welcoming your thoughts about all of this. 800-486-8655. Here is Timothy and Facebook message. I just wonder, from Anthony, I just wonder what the difference is between the tobacco industry getting sued and paying because they know they were selling a product that kills people versus the gun industry, which sells products that kill people and are only meant to kill people.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The parallel between tobacco and guns has been made for a long time. And in fact, the tobacco litigation predated the litigation against the gun industry largely. And what the many analysts have seen is that plaintiffs' lawyers learned a lot about how to take on a large industry like the gun industry by watching the tobacco industry. And in fact, many of the law firms that were involved in bringing lawsuits against the tobacco industry, which was really a 25-year campaign and involved a lot of law firms around the country, many of those were the same law firms that took on the gun industry starting in the 1990s. So the parallel has been there for a long time. I think there are some important differences between tobacco and firearms, and one of them is that pretty much every use of tobacco is harmful to health, and that's not true of firearms. Firearms have a variety of either shooting, you know, sporting purposes or self-defense purposes where the gun need not be fired but can just be brandished that might be a use or a valid use of the gun that don't involve any harm to anybody. And furthermore, of course, the United States Constitution under the Second Amendment protects the private right to own firearms, and that protection does not extend to tobacco. So while there are many parallels, there are a number of important differences between these two cases. I also think politically there was a very important public health shift in American attitudes about tobacco and smoking. And that cultural shift and changing in attitudes about smoking actually helped propel Congress to grant the FDA greater authority to regulate tobacco. And we haven't seen a cultural shift like that around guns. And in fact, if anything, we may have seen a more entrenchment on both sides about gun control. There's been a lot of greater enthusiasm, and there's been growth in the NRA over time, and there's been growing sense of Second Amendment protections, including in the Supreme Court, about firearms. And so I think, and if anything, we're not likely to see that sort of cultural change, and I don't think we're likely to see guns regulated anywhere like we're seeing tobacco regulated now, at least not anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Hasn't there been, though, a cultural shift when it comes to some things like background checks?
Well, we've had background checks for quite some time now, dating back to the Clinton administration, and those federal background checks, and even earlier we had different forms of federal background checks, those background checks have pretty much stayed the same. I think much of the scholarly literature indicates that background checks are useful and that they do help to keep guns out of the hands of a certain number of people who might otherwise obtain them through legal purchases at gun stores. But there's not a lot of sense in the literature, or there's at least a lot of debate about additional types of sales restrictions, and there certainly isn't the political will when it comes to additional types of restrictions. So we're likely to keep gun sales restrictions that we have, background checks aren't going to be repealed anytime soon, but I don't really think we're likely to see any additions to them either.
Okay.
I think as far as the legislative arena is concerned, we're pretty much in a stalemate and we're likely to stay there, and that the Badger Gun case sort of opens the door for some other venue mm-hmm. by which we might address this problem.
Jeff in Green Bay, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon, Kathleen and Timothy. Great program. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I worked for a specialty retailer that lost its FFL, and primarily due to tracking firearms within the company, you know, shotguns that were supposed to be there weren't there, that sort of thing, not so much background check issues. And I guess my question for Timothy is, what is the criteria that ATF uses to determine when it's appropriate to pull a federal firearm license from a retailer?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure that there are specific regulations that the ATF uses as factors to try and figure this out. I know certainly in the case of Badger Guns, which is the case we are talking about today, that the ATF pulled the license or threatened to pull the license and they changed ownership, and so it was relatively easy for them to regain it. But one thing that I can say is that there may often be a gap between the particular factors that are in play in terms of what the actual regulations say and how administrative discretion is exercised by the agency. And depending on what part of the country you're talking about, there may be more or less pressure for the ATF to be more or less aggressive with regard to policing. And I think it also depends on the retailer. I mean, if you have a retailer who carries a variety of different sporting items, including firearms, that retailer may be very nervous if stock goes missing or they're tied to shootings about their reputation. I think that's less true for a store like Badger Guns.
Right, and I guess the question, another question I had was, is it in any way dependent upon the types of firearms a store sells? So in the instance with my former employer, you know, it was shotguns, hunting rifles, some handguns, nothing that would meet the kind of questionable criteria I think Badger was accused of. Does the type of firearms that a store sells raise red flags with the ATF at all?
Well, the firearm in question at Badger Guns was not an unremarkable. It was a semi-automatic pistol, and it's the type of firearm that's regularly purchased by people for self-defense or sporting purposes. And I don't think that certainly not in the Badger case, that the type of gun is really at issue. The real question is the store's sales practices. And I think if you're talking about a major retailer in your case that's not keeping track of its stock or not tracking its stock, then independent of the type of gun, there would be a lot of concern among regulators about whether or not that store is responsible enough to carry a federal firearms license.
Mm-hmm. What was the policy at the store? And let me ask you this, too, Timothy. What's the policy for storing of guns? Do you have to have extra duty, extra special security at a store that sells a lot of weapons? Did you at the store where you worked at, Jeff?
No, really the only policy was essentially you had to keep a log of each serial number of every firearm. And, you know, there were, if I remember right, there were regular inspections. I don't remember if they were biannual or annual. And a representative of ATF would come in, look at your logs, compare the logs with the firearms in stock. So if you have a situation where an employee, an owner, someone else, to use the term borrowed a firearm for personal use, and that didn't show up in the log that day, it was that kind of activity, if I remember correctly, that led to the license being yanked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd also point out it's somewhat uncommon to have ATF come that regularly to a store. ATF has relatively limited inspection resources, and there are a very large number of federal firearms licensees. There are fewer now than there were 10 years ago, but even still, the ATF really does not have the capacity to go around and make regular annual visits to every single gun store. And in fact, that's not just true of ATF. That's true throughout federal regulation, that agencies have these huge jurisdictions with very large responsibilities in very, you know, nationwide industries, and they just don't have the inspection resources to be that scrutinizing. So it may be that certain stores, especially large retailers, come under closer scrutiny than smaller stores. But my understanding is there's a wide variety of different types of practices for storage. Now, there was a lawsuit out of, if you'll remember, the D.C. sniper case. There was a 2005 sniper case where a man was hiding in the trunk of a car and he mm-hmm. shot people in D.C. and they would drive the car around and many people were injured. The Brady Center helped the victims bring a lawsuit against Bushmaster in that case and the gun store for negligent storage practices of weapons. And that case actually was settled and the plaintiffs were given some compensation and settlement. So the whole issue of safe storage practices is definitely something that has come up in the civil liability context before.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Jeff, for your interesting call. We'll take more in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. Timothy Litton is our guest, distinguished university professor and professor of law at Georgia State University. He's the author of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. We're giving special emphasis to the case in Milwaukee, a police officer suing Badger Guns for claiming, and a jury agreed with him, that a store clerk there knowingly sold a gun, an illegal straw purchase, and the jury awarded the police officers who were subsequently shot and very badly wounded $5.7 million. Two more of your calls in a moment. Our lines are all filled right now, but just remember the number, okay? 800-486-8655, or leave a message on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or send an email at talk@WPR.org, or, that'll do it for now. All right, back to you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To Anthony from Milwaukee next. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Great.
Good. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, well, I was just listening in. And I live in Milwaukee. Actually, I'm like 5 minutes away from the Badger, where it used to be Badgers, you know. It's not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a convicted felon. And it's just, you know, on that note, it's just too easy for convicted felons to get their hands on firearms. It's just too easy.
Where do you get them, Anthony?
I mean, basically, it's just all through the area. I mean, you got, okay, I became a convicted felon, like, in the 90s. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I recently had was charged with felon in possession of a firearm. I was indicted federally.
Mm-hmm.
So I was arrested. I was incarcerated. You know, and I did my time, and I came home. But it's just that these kids are out here in the inner city, and it seems that at 14, 16 years of age, they have guns, and it's coming through. The 21-year-olds are buying them,
mm-hmm,
and passing them down. And that's the problem. So we don't see enough, we don't see enough people out here trying to get these guns out of these kids' hands. Now, me, I'm 48 years of age, so I've kind of matured, and I kind of know better, you know. And the circumstances how I ended up with the last firearm was I took it from a kid, and I had put it in my home, and I had the firearm for over 6 years stored in my house, and an argument ensued with me and my fiance, and the gun was implemented in the argument, so therefore I was charged with felon in possession of a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see enough of the authority talking to these kids or promoting, you know, to get these guns out of these kids' hands. You don't see it in the inner city. I mean, for good example, overseas, when our troops went overseas to fight the Taliban, and the Taliban was recruiting kids over there, the government put out leaflets, and they dropped them from helicopters and airplanes, and they did everything they could to deter these kids from joining the terrorist organizations. We don't have that in there. We don't have commercials, you know, telling these kids to stay away from these guns or the consequences. We don't have leaflets or anything. You know, it just seems that since the law passed for these guns, that the inner city has been flooded with them.
Yeah, I know they have. And tell me, Anthony, why do you think, why would you want a gun when you were 14 or 16? Is it gang-related, or what the heck is it?
Well, from what I gather from these kids, it's because he has one.
Right.
You know, this is it, because he has one, and I don't want to be out, and I don't want to be out without one. And this is the conversation that I'm having with these kids, and it's just, and that's the trend. He has one.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know.
Stay with us. Let's get Timothy responding to what you said, Timothy.
Well, I think Anthony points out something very important to keep in mind here, which is that regulating gun stores, while it may provide us some marginal advantage or marginal gain in dealing with the flow of illegal weapons into the hands of people who don't aren't entitled to own them, is really a relatively small proportion of what we're talking about. The streets are awash in guns. I mean, in the United States, we have more than 300 million firearms in private hands, and there are 50 million households with guns. That's 40%. There are guns everywhere in our culture, and straw purchases, while they may be a serious problem that we can address, are a relatively small problem. And that, even gun liability, suing the industry, is really only sort of chipping away at what I've called before the low-hanging fruit. Anthony raises a much larger question about what are we going to do about the fact that the streets are awash in guns, mm-hmm. and that to bring them back might involve a level of policing mm-hmm. that is certainly, as we've seen in the last year, the country may not have the stomach for.
Yeah.
So it's really a difficult problem. On the one hand, it's important to try and find ways to remove guns from the streets, and on the other hand, we don't want to have overly aggressive policing going through and searching through people's homes when, there might not be valid grounds for it. So it's a difficult question, and it shows that I think gun violence and the problem of gun possession is so much larger than just the lawsuits that we've seen getting a lot of attention.
Now,
yes, Anthony.
Where I live in inner city, we come across illegal searches all the time. Illegal search and seizure. But I think that, we need that. But are you fighting the war on crime, the guns, the drugs, or are you fighting the war on these kids? Because if you're going to illegal search me, and I'm illegally carrying drugs or a firearm or whatever, and you just drive up, pats me down, go in my pocket, and you take the contraband off of me, that's one thing. Now you're doing the war on the drugs and the crime. But you also broke the law to get me, and then I also stand in front of a judge and get found guilty. So that's the flip of the coin I got. So are you actually fighting the war on crime and drugs, or are you fighting the war on these kids? See, that's the question. Now, if you want to legally search me and take it from me, that's one thing. Okay, you got me. I was mm-hmm. wrong. Take it. That's that. But to take it illegally and prosecute me and convict me when the law, I have a constitutional right to have rights too.
Thanks, Anthony, very much for your call. And you make me think about doing a show. We should do a show on why there are so many 14- and 16-year-olds who have guns and what we do about that, because it's obviously a big problem. Timothy?
I think that Anthony raises another point that's important, which is that it sounds like from his experience, many of the children who are obtaining weapons now are obtaining them because the other guy has them. In other words, they're obtaining them for a measure of self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, many people who own firearms obtain them because they are concerned about self-defense. And that's really the core of the Second Amendment's protection of firearm ownership in the United States. In 2008, the United States Supreme Court declared in a case called D.C. versus Heller that the Second Amendment protects private ownership of a weapon, and it protects weapons that are in common use for lawful purposes like self-defense. And the court made specific reference to self-defense as really the core of the Second Amendment right to own a private firearm. So I think that we need to keep in mind also that what kids are doing really is just trying to obtain weapons for precisely the same reason that many adults want to obtain these weapons, which is they're frightened of their circumstances, and the Constitution protects an adult's right to own that weapon, but not a child's, and I'm not sure the children respect that difference.
Right. 14-year-olds with guns. Well, Timothy, thank you very much. It was a highly informative show. You really know your subject matter, and we thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Timothy Litton, distinguished university professor and professor of law at Georgia State University. We're going to try and track down Anthony for a show because it sounds like he has a lot to talk about, too. And we're talking, we were this hour, about Badger Guns and the lawsuit against the store for an illegal straw purchase that took place. The jury awarded the two policemen who were very seriously hurt, $5.7 million, and what that means in terms of immunity that gun stores have. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News is coming up, and Norman Lear will be joining us the second hour of our program.